Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments Podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor for Neurology Live. In this episode, we sat down with Dr. Carl Dugramji, the director of the Sleep Disorders Center and a professor of neurology and psychiatry at Thomas Jefferson University and Jefferson Health. He shared his perspective on the current state of care for sleep disorders, as well as commented on the impact that the pandemic has had on sleep and the population in the United States, and some of the recent advances in both therapeutics and on the research side of things. So without further ado, let's dive in.
My name is Dr. Carl Dugramji. I'm professor of psychiatry in the Department of Psychiatry and Human Behavior at Thomas Jefferson University. I'm also a professor of neurology and medicine. I also direct the Jefferson Sleep Disorder Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Good to be here with all of you. Yeah, so one of the big areas of recognition, or one of the biggest areas that we've been thinking about over the past few years has been the role of sleep in our emotional and physical lives, especially with the onset of the COVID pandemic. Many of us have been suffering from various disturbances of sleep and so on and so forth. And some of the data that are emerging are indicating to us that a critical amount of sleep is important for all of us. For example, in the newborn ages, 14 to 17 hours of sleep seem to be relevant. And for toddlers and infants, something right along the lines of 11 to 14 hours. But even in adults, it seems that a minimum of 8 hours or so of sleep on a regular basis seems to be important. And we're also discovering that diminishing the amount of sleep that we get is impactful in terms of all sorts of cognitive functioning. For example, response time diminishes, our memory begins to decline, we are less efficient in learning new things, our ability to concentrate and focus diminishes, and even our emotional lives tend to experience decrements. Some of the physical consequences of poor sleep or reduced amounts of sleep are also becoming more and more clear to us. For example, we know that sleeplessness or lower levels of sleep increase our sensitivity to pain stimuli. So people suffering from pain disorders become more acutely impaired. And the opposite is true also, interestingly, that by sleeping more, we become less sensitive to pain, or we begin to, so we can sort of overcome pain more efficiently. Sleep disturbances tend to aggravate lung disturbances and hypoxemia, increase blood pressure, and seem to be relevant in the development of obesity, interestingly, by changing the ghrelin-leptin ratio in the wrong direction. One of the questions has always become, how does this happen? How does it happen that sleep can result in some of these derangements? And some fascinating research over the last couple of years has begun to show us that there is a intricate system called the glymphatic system within the central nervous system or brain that's responsible for the elimination of wastes and poisons that accumulate inside the interstitial fluid of the brain, including beta amyloid and tau protein. And this elimination process is most efficient and robust during sleep. And sleeplessness then seems to result in the accumulation of these poisonous compounds in the brain and may result in some of the poor or some of the decrements and performance issues that I was just talking about. So sleep seems to be such an important part of our lives, and this has been something which we're becoming much more aware of over the past few years.
It's interesting because we've had conversations this year about that sort of topic, and one of them was kind of framed speaking to Dr. Raman Malhotra out of the University of Washington, St. Louis, and he was saying, that because the AASM put out this, sleep is essential position statement earlier than a year. And it's interesting because, you think of, as especially as a layperson,
You know, obviously sleep is important. It's something you do every day. You spend, you know, one third of your life doing it. But it is interesting that, you know, among these number of epidemics in the United States, particularly with obesity and heart health, that sleep until now really hasn't been part of that. There's really been no focus on, you know, are people getting enough sleep? Or, you know, how, what are sort of the, you know, as you're saying, the detriments to not getting enough sleep? So for you, you know, is the awareness there? Because again, I know everybody knows sleep is important, but it, from a clinician perspective, is the awareness of just how important it is in terms of the potential detrimental effects of not getting enough, is that kind of there across the board?
I think we're getting better at it, Matt, but we're not where we need to be. And we see this throughout the board. I mean, we have patients coming in with various disturbances, mood disorders, for example, or difficulties with functioning, not recognizing that sleeplessness or poor sleep may be a factor in the genesis of those abnormalities. And one of the reasons, I think, is that the effects of sleeplessness are not necessarily things that we are consciously always aware of. Sleepiness, for example, which is the tendency to fall asleep at inappropriate times, or excessive sleepiness, that is something which we may not be subjectively that aware of. Interestingly, we get used to it over longer periods of time, times of sleeplessness, and begin to be less sensitive to its effects consciously. So one of the issues is that conscious awareness is not always there, even in cases of very high levels of sleepiness, where people are falling asleep while driving, operating machinery, and so on and so forth. So awareness is still not there, not as acutely as it is, for example, with heart disease and lung diseases and other conditions. So I think we have a lot more work to do here. I think this is especially true also in youngsters. You know, the role of poor sleep in the production of obesity and metabolic disturbances in children is now beginning to emerge, and also the role of sleeplessness in poor learning or diminished learning ability is beginning to emerge. So I think we have more work to do, but I certainly think we've made some significant impact in awareness over the past decade or two.
And then, you know, speaking to a number of, because it does seem like in recent years, and, you know, you've obviously alluded to these sort of links that are being identified, you know, the role that poor sleep may play in the development of cognitive dysfunction down the road, or, you know, these other issues, you know, how they may compound things. For you, when it comes to actually conducting sleep research, you know, one of the topics over the past couple of years that we've touched on is the sort of challenge of getting accurate measurements, because, you know, asking patients to come in and do a sleep study, they're not in their normal sleeping habitat. And I know some companies have come out with these, or, you know, in the midst of developing these sort of at-home measurement tools. For you, where is the research field at with that? Do you think that the data that's being collected is adequate, or, you know, are we sort of in the infancy of getting to the point where we can collect better and more rich data?
I think we are, it's safe to say that we are in the infancy of this process. Right now, the tools that are available for consumer, on a consumer level, unfortunately, have not yet crossed into the medical field in a way that we can say that the assessment is, our assessments are reliable and have a great deal of validity. So, but I do think, though, Matt, that these tools, even though they're not necessarily accurate in the real medical sense of the word, do serve an important positive function, and that is to increase awareness on the part of the public in terms of sleep. So I do see this every day, that people look at their watches, their monitors, and want to assess how well are they sleeping? Are they sleeping enough, sufficiently, and so on? And at least that sense of monitoring oneself from a sleep standpoint, which is so difficult to do subjectively, is enhanced with these types of devices. But I have no doubt that in the future, possibly within the next decade or so, we'll see the transformation of many of the things that we do on a medical level now, for example, in the sleep laboratory or in the context of the home sleep testing environment, medical sleep testing environment. We'll see the transformation of these technologies from this sort of complex process into the everyday monitoring of wristwatches possibly, or devices that are pasted on the skin, so that people can on an everyday level measure how well they're sleeping, their levels of daytime sleepiness, as by the way also with other functions such as blood pressure, heart rhythm disturbances, and so on. So it's exciting. The future is exciting, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how those, you know, if any, how those devices sort of do get incorporated, if they end up being validated for clinical trial purposes and so on and so forth.
Right.
You know, obviously, because like I said, that one sticking point that I've noticed in a lot of these conversations is just the you know, getting that true sleep measurement is very difficult when you ask a patient to come into a sleep laboratory, you know, not sleep where they're comfortable, that sort of thing. On the therapeutic side of things, obviously, there's been a couple approvals in the last year or so. For you, what's sort of been, the biggest step forward on the therapeutic side? And then just in the pipeline, is there anything coming that you're excited about or keeping an eye on?
Sure. Well, you know, if we're talking about insomnia, it's such a common disturbance. We think that around half the population experiences this at some point within the course of their lives. And it has such great consequences in terms of how people, in terms of their everyday mental, emotional, as well as their physical lives. One of the biggest, I think, areas of awareness for us in insomnia is the fact that non-medication strategies are so effective. Cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, is so helpful in alleviating insomnia in an acute level, but also providing lasting benefit. Of course, one of the challenges we've had with this is that there's a paucity of therapists who are qualified to deliver this. And a very nice and positive development over the past few years has been the transformation of cognitive behavioral therapy into the online realm. We have now a few programs that are available, apps and so on, that provide predictable and proven benefit for patients who have insomnia in a non-medication fashion. So this is a good day for insomnia. In addition, from a pharmacologic standpoint, we've had hypnotics or sleeping pills there for many, many years. The challenge, though, has been that many of these are riddled with side effects, primarily daytime sleepiness, cognitive concerns, motor abnormalities, the risk of falls, hip fractures in the elderly is enhanced with some of these long-acting hypnotic medications. Respiratory disturbances seem to be fomented with some of these agents as well. And over the past decade or so, we've seen the development of safer and safer medications. The GABA receptor agonists were so helpful. But in the past decade, we've seen the development of melatonin receptor agonists, as well as histamine receptor antagonists. And the most recent introduction are those of the orexin receptor antagonists. You know, the orexin system is one which is responsible for wakefulness and coordinates the activity of other wake neurotransmitters throughout the central nervous system. And the antagonizing this system seemingly, it seems to be very helpful in the production of sleep. And these agents seem to have an index of safety that is unparalleled. So this has been these are some of the exciting developments, I think, in the field of sleep medicine. I think the future probably we'll see the development of more of these orexin receptor antagonists, but I think also that we're going to be seeing some interestingly, some devices being developed and introduced. In fact, one of them is on the market now, which have various mechanisms. One, for example, is involved in cooling the brain or cooling the head. And interestingly, this when worn at nighttime seems to produce better sleep. So there are other devices which are being developed which may help change the EEG spectrum of individuals during sleep and help them sleep better, possibly. So some other ones introduce auditory tones during sleep, and some, in fact, direct brain signals in a specific direction. So the future is promising, and I think very exciting in the area of insomnia.
Absolutely. For you, you know, you mentioned CBT, and obviously that was sort of one of the headlines of one of the recent guideline updates. So for you, with all that's going on and sort of everything that's kind of on the cusp of coming into the field potentially over the next 5 to 10 years, what are some of the areas in need in terms of practical guidance? Do you think that clinicians are aware, particularly, I would imagine, you know, those who are focused on sleep are, but, you know, the general neurology community or even the primary care community who may be sort of the first line of defense in identifying these issues in patients, do you think that they're aware of these new agents and these new devices, or, you know, is there kind of that trickle down of getting the guidelines in front of them and getting these updates in front of them? Is that sort of a slow uptake?
Yeah, I do think that awareness is always a challenge. And more specifically, you know, there's a need for education and awareness in the area of how does one select a specific hypnotic agent for a particular use. We now are at the point where there's so many hypnotics available that we can actually be selective in tailoring the hypnotic to the specific clinical characteristics of the patient. For example, in sleep onset insomnia difficulties, or having when patients have more difficulty falling asleep, a certain cadre of agents is more effective and indicated for that purpose, whereas other agents are more helpful and more productive for sleep maintenance insomnias, or when patients have more difficulty waking up repeatedly during the course of the day. When there are comorbid respiratory issues, for example, COPD or obstructive sleep apnea, some agents have proven to be safer than others in this particular clinical realm. When patients have histories of substance use or abuse, some agents are non-scheduled and may be preferentially used in these areas. Age, age factor is an important one, because as we age, the benzodiazepine receptor agonists seem to have more detrimental effects in terms of daytime motor functioning and memory and so on. Some of the newer agents may be more desirable in these areas. So I do think education is needed in the proper choice of selection of certain agents over others in the treatment of insomnia.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Doug Ramji to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. Amylyx Pharmaceuticals, shortly after announcing the submission of a new drug application for its investigational ALS agent, AMX-35, initiated the Phase 3 Phoenix study of the therapy. The first of the target 600 patients were dosed in the trial, which is set to span roughly 65 sites in the United States and Europe. One key difference from the prior Centaur trial, which is supporting the NDA, is that those enrolled in Phoenix must have a clinically definite or probable ALS diagnosis within 24 hours of symptom onset, compared with the 18-month window allowed in Centaur. Additionally, the FDA has approved the first oral solution of topiramate from Azurity Pharmaceuticals, marketed as Eprontia. The agent, which is administered in a dose of 25 milligrams per milliliter, was given the green light for the treatment of epilepsy and migraine. Specifically, it can be used orally as a monotherapy or adjunctive therapy for partial onset or primary generalized tonic-clonic seizures in those aged 2 years and older, as well as for seizures associated with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome in those aged 2 years and older. For migraine, it can be used as a preventative in those aged 12 years and older. Our final bit of news today is the announcement that the Biden administration has nominated Robert Califf as the next FDA commissioner. He formerly headed the agency during the Obama administration, serving from February 2016 until January of 2017. A cardiologist by trade, Califf was appointed deputy commissioner of the FDA's Office of Medical Products and Tobacco in 2015 after serving a 35-year career at Duke University. Califf will be taking over for acting commissioner Janet Woodcock, who could not legally hold the post past November 15th. For more information about these stories, you can head to neurologylive.com or check out the corresponding links in the show notes. And now, back to Dr. Doug Ramji.
And then outside of insomnia, are there any, areas of therapeutic need? Because obviously, again, that sort of seems like it's been not a focus, but just in terms of how the pipeline's moved along, kind of an area that's gotten a little help, so to speak, over the last year or so. Are there any other conditions that you think are really kind of in need or maybe not getting enough attention when it comes to therapeutic development or just really, awareness on that management level?
Sure. Well, certainly the disorders characterized by central nervous system hypersomnias, the disorders such as narcolepsy, idiopathic hypersomnia, Klein-Levin syndrome, sleepiness in general is a very common problem in our society as well. And although narcolepsy is a very small contributor to that prevalence, it actually represents a model disorder, if you will, of sleepiness, where the therapeutics in narcolepsy can help us understand potential therapeutic agents for other areas of daytime sleepiness. And the pharmacotherapy of narcolepsy has always been a challenge for many decades because all we've had available to us have been the scheduled stimulants, which have an array of side effects as well. Agents such as modafinil, armodafinil have been around for a few decades and are wake-promoting agents. And more recently introduced has been solriamfetol, which has not only dopamine, but also norepinephrine properties, and pitolisant, which is a histamine agent. These agents have really been very, very helpful in treating narcolepsy and hypersomnias. And most recently, we've seen the introduction of sodium oxybate, as well as its low-sodium cousin, if you will, low-sodium oxybate, for the treatment of idiopathic hypersomnia, a cousin of narcolepsy characterized by the lack of REM symptoms or REM types of clinical findings such as cataplexy, sleep paralysis, and hypnagogic hallucinations, but representing, I think, a large portion of the central nervous system hypersomnias. So there are now a number of agents available to us for the treatment of these disorders of central hypersomnia, which in the past have been very, very difficult to treat.
And then speaking to the diagnosis side of things, because you sort of mentioned a few things that differentiate some of these related disorders, but then obviously there are others. So for you, obviously, again, awareness and patient and physician education in terms of identifying patients who are complaining about sleep issues or, maybe potentially patients who are undiagnosed with something. When those patients are identified, how's the current state of diagnosis? Are there still challenges in properly diagnosing patients with certain disorders or differentiating one from another?
We see this, unfortunately, still. On the primary care level, simply identification of patients who have sleep disturbances is still a challenge. In the regular history and physical, intake history and physical, or even in follow-up settings, incorporating questions about sleeplessness or daytime sleepiness is still a challenge and not done in a wide variety of clinical settings. Even in the arena of the specialists, such as the neurologists and the psychiatrists, the data unfortunately show that those sorts of questions are not being routinely asked. It's so important to do so. But even after doctors, clinicians of various kinds ask the question and get a positive finding along the lines of many of these symptoms, we're finding that the a methodologically a sound way of addressing these, the evaluation process, arriving at a definitive diagnosis, or arriving at a workup strategy, is still lacking in many, many clinical contexts. So we have a lot of work to do. In the arena of the specialists, such as the sleep medicine practitioners, we of course, have the sophisticated diagnostic techniques, practitioners who are educated in diagnosis. The challenge there is one of availability of services. We see that practitioners are so inundated with patients that in many cases patients are having access difficulties to these specialized settings. And interestingly, even in these very specialized settings, in sleep medicine settings, the focus seems to be in many areas on sleep-related breathing disturbances and asking questions which elicit things like narcolepsy or idiopathic hypersomnia is still a bit of a challenge because of various factors, including the fact that it does take some time to delve into the diagnosis of narcolepsy and idiopathic hypersomnia. So we have challenges across the board, as you can see, in many of these areas.
Yeah, I'm glad you, well, not glad, obviously, because it being an issue is not great, but I'm glad in a sense that you brought that up, because I was going to ask, you know, obviously there's been a lot of conversation about this physician shortage that the United States is facing. And I know a paper was published this year in neurology that shows that obviously the neurology subspecialty and related areas are kind of really being hit quite hard by that. And I'm curious, you know, as we sort of move across the board toward this comprehensive care model, you know, obviously, as you mentioned, the demand, the ability to supply the demand of sleep specialists isn't necessarily being met. But how often are sleep specialists being incorporated into that care model? Because I would imagine that, you know, outside of sleep specific issues, a lot of patients with neurologic disease are probably experiencing sleep issues from, you know, just a number of different, for whether it's pain related or just they have some sort of comorbid condition. So do you find that, you know, the sleep specialists are kind of being incorporated in that care model as often as they should be, or is that still kind of a challenge?
Not at all. And I think it's safe to say that there's significant challenges here. This model of a comprehensive care model, which incorporates multiple disciplines, including sleep, neurology, psychiatry, into one setting, is still something which many centers are still working on developing, but we're still not there. We've developed something like this at my host institution at Jefferson, along the lines of primary care and sleep medicine for the management of sleep apnea. So there is within the context of primary care, heightened awareness for sleep apnea by implementing some screening models, including what's called a STOP or STOP inventory, and a positive or highly positive screen on that level of triggers a sleep medicine evaluation, which could include a sleep medicine physician's consult, as well as testing, either home sleep testing or in laboratory testing. And we're just beginning to have some data emerge from this, showing us how well we've captured patients in this population. But you know, these types of coordinated models are far and few in between, and we still need to do a lot more work in developing these models. One of the interesting things that's been happening over the past few years is that the training programs in sleep medicine are beginning to incorporate specialists or specialists from multiple disciplines. It used to be that sleep medicine fellowship programs admitted primarily neurologists, pulmonologists, and psychiatrists. Now we're seeing the influx of family physicians and primary care individuals in internal medicine. And these physicians are emerging into practices of primary care practices where now as sleep specialists are beginning to incorporate sleep medicine into their primary care everyday work, which I think is a very exciting finding for me, exciting development for me, because now we can see the incorporation of sleep medicine and right into the arena where we see sleep disorders the most, that is in the arena of primary care.
Yeah, it's interesting. That sort of seems to follow, you know, you hear a lot when we talk to neurologists specifically who subspecialize, you know, I know the migraine community is probably screaming at the top of their lungs about how, you know, there's not enough education for medical students on migraine. You know, it's like 2 minutes of your total course. And it sounds like there's a similar issue with sleep. Do you think that some sort of, and maybe these are available, but some sort of certification for primary care providers would be helpful in just giving them sort of a baseline, you know, here's the line of questioning you can go about, just getting it incorporated, like you mentioned, sort of into that care process?
And that's a fascinating thought. Just to underline what you said, the average time that we devote to education in sleep medicine at a medical school level was assessed a few years ago as being around 35 minutes to a process which where we spend a third of our lives. You know, absolutely. So yeah, a certificate program, a specialized training program. We can also think along the lines of incentives being provided from third-party payers. for improvement of sleep or for improvement of metrics relative to sleep on a primary care level or even in the neurologic and psychiatric setting. So absolutely. I think though, Matt, you know, in all fairness, we still have some work to do in terms of convincing all of us as a medical profession about the role and importance of sleep and its impact in terms of human functioning. There's so many other competing processes in clinical medicine for that specific type of awareness that I think in sleep, we're just our educational processes are just sort of beginning to emerge. So absolutely, education on a medical school level, on a residency level, and certificate or other programs on a graduate level would, I think, be very, very highly helpful.
Absolutely. And then, so speaking to that, one of the last questions I want to ask you is, and this may open up a can of worms, but speaking to that research that's being done that hopefully, you know, as it sort of bears out, will impact the education and our understanding on sleep. But I know one of the things, obviously, you talked about at a meeting this year, the International Future Neurology meeting, was, you know, what you alluded to at the very beginning of this conversation, the glymphatic system and just sort of understanding sleep's downstream effects on, you know, things like dementia and cognitive function. For you, you know, that seems to be an area that could potentially draw a lot of interest in terms of, you know, raising flags about the awareness around sleep. So for you, you know, what's sort of the keys of that research right now? What are sort of the key things that the clinical community should be aware of, just where we're at with that and what's going on in that area?
Yeah, I mean, it is a fascinating area. So the glymphatic system, we're now beginning to recognize, is so important in maintaining brain integrity on a cellular level, and that system is most active during sleep. So there right there is a very important connection between sleep and the maintenance of proper brain function on a cellular level. I mean, this is a key area of awareness for us. And there are a number of diseases which we now know are more likely to occur in patients who are sleep deprived. And you brought up the area of Alzheimer's disease with the dementia processes. Now we do have long-term data clearly showing us that low levels of sleep or poor sleep is associated with higher levels of development of Alzheimer's and various dementing processes. So we have the data. And interestingly, we also have data showing us that enhancing sleep with medications, even benzodiazepines, is helpful in diminishing the levels of these poisonous compounds like beta amyloid and building up in the central nervous system, and even have a positive impact in terms of some clinical parameters. So we have the data, and the future is exciting. There's so many laboratories now working on developing compounds which can sort of promote this system of the glymphatic system. And by developing these compounds, we can see where we're headed to a point in time where possibly we can, by improving sleep at the same time, be able to enhance a number of areas of neurocognitive function.
It'd be interesting to see how that rolls out, as, you know, I'm just obviously making very sort of speculative assumptions in my brain, but, you know, you kind of tie these things together where we have conversations with dementia specialists who talk about, you know, maybe part of the issue here is we're not getting to patients early enough. And you think, well, sleep kind of gets to them early enough because it's getting to them the whole time. So it'll be interesting to see how that research pairs out over the next couple of years. The last thing I want to ask you is just, you know, looking back on 2021 as a whole, obviously a lot of exciting stuff going on this year, despite the fact that, you know, 2020 and the coronavirus pandemic that's been ongoing has kind of made some things challenging. For you, you know, whether it's looking back on this year, you know, a big advancement or a big step forward, or looking forward to 2022, specifically what you're excited about, I'm just sort of curious your sort of summarized thoughts of this year in sleep medicine. What's sort of, like I said, either a big step that you think is setting us up for success next year, or something that's sort of rolling along that's going to make an impact as we go into the next 6 months to a year?
Well, I mean, I think the most important aspect of sleep that we become aware of is how important it is for our emotional and physical lives by virtue of the COVID pandemic. the number of complaints relative to sleep have increased dramatically. Not only being sleepy, but also not sleeping well at night, and also in correlation with this, the diminished mood, diminished productivity on an individual level. And we've also seen how improving one's environment, sleep-wake environment, can be so helpful in restoring some of that function. So we've always talked about this, but I think the COVID pandemic, if it's done anything positive, is to point out to us how important that sleep can be, and has increased our level of attention to sleep, and has made our patients much more not only aware, but has given them the armamentarium to help themselves in the future. So I think we can only build on this in the future, and I'm seeing next year as being possibly an important one for us to emerge from COVID and begin to sleep better.
Listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.